Hey everyone, it's Nathaniel. Welcome back to the Film Experience Podcast. I have a special guest today, Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks, who you are familiar with if you've ever listened to the podcast. Today we're traveling back in time for a retrospective. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about 1986 because we're so in the now.
We are, and we know that you guys were all negative three, but it was a big year.
Yeah, it's the 25th anniversary, and since I had just done Hit Me With Your Best Shot for Aliens, and Nick has recently started, well, you're already quite a ways into it, but it seemed like a massive project of reviewing the entire Cannes roster.
Yeah, in fact, let's just say I'm in the south of France, because that's why I'm doing this. It's my staycation for summer.
So are you doing any, like, self-tanning procedures?
Everybody who knows me knows I have never tanned or self-tanned, even when trying. No, I'm still as pathetically pale as possible. Thank God for the breadth of French beauty standards.
You're in the south of France, but no topless starlets trying to distract you.
Well, one wonders how much topless starlets would distract me, but depends what kind you're talking about, I suppose. And it's already that kind of podcast.
Well, the first thing I wanted to get out of the way, because it's one of the first things that you reviewed, is Fool for Love.
Oh, yeah.
We both love Kim Basinger in the movie.
Yes.
But from my understanding, that was a 1985 movie for the Oscars.
Here's what happened. Nothing ever changes. So the U.S. was bombing Libya when this Cannes Film Festival happened. And the U.S. hadn't done super well at the Cannes Festival in the years preceding anyway. And so they sent four movies. They picked four American movies, but I guess the ones they were given to choose from were mostly from 85. So they were holdovers here, but it wasn't about premieres. So Runaway Train was old. After Hours was old.
Okay. And yeah, because you had mentioned Runaway Train, too, and I was like, huh.
Yeah. And no Americans went to support the movies because they were terrified that that Cannes was going to be bombed. So everybody pulled out. Scorsese, Spielberg. Rosanna Arquette didn't go.
Rosanna.
Exactly. So it's like no American movie stars in old American movies, and that was what we had to bring.
Well, what won the Palme d'Or?
The Mission. But I'm seeing tons of stuff that I've never crossed paths with at all.
From all over the world.
Yeah, like this really great Indian movie that I just watched, and the French stuff was really good. And
for your staycation, are you just stationed in front of the TV?
It feels that way, yeah. I sort of go to the south of France in the mornings, and then I go to my job feeling like I've taken my trip to France, and then I'm back writing again in the evening.
You keep yourself on a rigid schedule.
It's a recession.
Fool for Love, if anybody hasn't seen it, is a Robert Altman adaptation of a Sam Shepard play.
With Sam Shepard starring.
And Kim Basinger. I haven't seen it in years and years, but it's a super tiny cast, right?
It is. It's the two of them and Harry Dean Stanton, who either really exists or doesn't exist, and that's not clear for a while. And then Randy Quaid shows up about halfway through, but that's almost it.
Does he glare at them with knowing looks like a Brokeback Mountain?
Or does he wear a caftan and attempt to evade the law like in real life? No, he just listens to the story we are already listening to, perhaps suggesting he doesn't need to be there. But yeah, it's one of those Robert Altman movies that feels like doesn't get a lot of play these days, but it's really, really good.
Readers, check that out. Kim Basinger is excellent in it. A little trivia note for you. 1985 was the first year where I had watched the Oscars before as a kid, but 1985 was the first year where I paid attention to it as like a race up to the nominations.
And the first one I ever saw was 1986. So
wow. Okay, well, and I still remember this, and Nick, you'll appreciate that. I think it was People magazine. It was either People or Us. And it was halfway through 1985 or in the fall or something. They had this two-page spread on Best Actress buzz.
Well, of course you would in 1985.
And it was like so many pictures of movies that I hadn't heard of. And they basically threw everyone in there. So they had like Madonna and Rosanna Arquette for Desperately Seeking Susan.
Oh, yeah.
Every leading actress of the year was in this two-page spread with a bunch of tiny photos. And they were like, and this is way before the nominations, too. I think it was the summer. And
Yeah.
I was like, what? It starts this early?
Yeah.
Anyway, Kim Basinger in Fool for Love was one of them. And then when I later saw the performance, which I think was much later, so everybody who wonders why she won the Oscar, she is kind of
Yeah.
an uneven actress, but when she's right for a part, sometimes there's magic.
Yep, that's true. And then she tries to work with that director again and again. Who wouldn't do that?
Right. I was really into the notion of Kim Basinger as a Best Actress nominee for 9.5 weeks in 1986.
Oh, I would have been perhaps less into that.
But I was having a Kim Basinger phase.
Oh, I didn't know that about you. See, we can still learn things about each other all these years later, Nathaniel.
I was really into her in the 80s. I was really mad that it was Glenn Close and not her who had been nominated for The Natural.
Ah.
Me and Kim, we go way back.
Making that officially the last time Kim Basinger and Glenn Close had ever competed for anything.
Well, the craziest thing about that cast is that it's Barbara Hershey, Kim Basinger, and Glenn Close.
Yeah.
And they were all beginning of their career. I guess Hershey had been around a while.
Yeah. But the beginning of a new part of her career for sure.
Right. So it was a major film for three of the most prominent 80s actresses.
You know where your life is headed when you go see The Natural and you're thinking about the actresses. For anybody out there who finds yourself doing that, that does mean something.
If you rented it on DVD specifically for Barbara Hershey, you're an actor-sexual.
You finished?
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
There's so many movies. Where should we even begin?
Well, let's start with Aliens because you've got all these great columns about it. And you just rewatched it, right?
I did, yeah.
And did you see
Although
that when it was out?
I did. I still remember a friend was driving me to the movie theater and we stopped to get gas. I still remember this vividly. And I was really, really scared to see the movie for some reason. I think I thought it was a horror movie, which I guess it kind of is.
Yeah.
He kept like shouting in the car, "I'm scared of the dark," and just saying all these things to make me laugh because I was nervous.
Well, you know, fair enough. Like, it's a really intense movie. Like, it just doesn't stop. I was really rattled, and I think I can't remember for sure whether my dad took me to see that in the theater, which would have been hilarious because I would have been 9. But, you know, one often goes to see Saw 6 and notices the 5-year-old's there, so I guess it's not that funny. But either it was there, or it was right on HBO, sort of right after it would have hit HBO. But I mean, I feel like I watched it every day for a certain period of my life. But it's really a freak out every time.
Yeah, and one thing that works in just about all of the movies, but I love particularly in Aliens, is how Geiger inspired art direction, how the aliens really are the environment.
Yeah.
And so when you first see them, it's always this freak out that they're actually the wall that you're
Oh
looking
my
at
God. Yes.
or the ceiling.
Or both.
It works every time.
Yeah, especially right after you. I mean, you just haven't had time to catch up from the woman stuck up there in the gelatin. You just don't get a break between that woman asking to be shot in the chest and then having the thing come out of her chest and then everybody freaking out and then the walls are alive. Like, I feel like the whole movie is that way. It's just, it's so relentless, but in an amazing way.
One of the things I'd totally forgotten about its intensity and the relentlessness is how quiet the pre-climax climax is, the one I wrote about the egg room.
Yes.
There's almost no underscore.
Yeah.
It's all just you watching these fierce ladies stare at each other, and most of the score is just their breath. And then when Ripley's getting the hell out of the Dodge, it's also this, I mean, the score comes back, but it's her face sweating and running.
And the loudspeaker about how much time before everything blows up, right?
Right.
My God.
Yeah, no, I just love that movie.
Freight elevators scared me the first time I was on them because of that movie. It gets everywhere.
Freight elevators scared me for the first time because of Fatal Attraction. I kid, I kid. But since we were in the 80s, the holy name of Glenn Close was already invoked.
I just want to be a part of your life. I mean, I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
So I feel confused at different times, and I suspect you must also, about whether you were a Kathleen Turner voter or a Sigourney Weaver voter, and we should just get it out. Because when you talk about either of them, you say, I would have voted for her.
I know. I'm channeling sort of all of the internet because people are constantly. No, I'm serious. Because people are constantly saying, oh, they should have won the Oscar, and they never stop to think about who the competition was. And you can't really have, 10 Oscar winners and Best Actress, even if it is 1987. Okay, at the time, I was 100% Kathleen Turner. 100%. And now I am still in Kathleen's corner, but I think I would tilt Sigourney.
So you would vote for Sigourney, but lie to Kathleen about that.
On the basis
Of
that I
who
had
knows,
already
yeah.
voted for Kathleen Turner before.
Fair enough.
It's weird to compare them because, they're vastly different movies. But both of those movies, for all of their auteurist cred, are completely reliant on their lead actress.
For sure.
And so any success that they do have, or any limitations that they do have, is really tied up in that, you know. Well, actually, that's overstating because Peggy Sue has some problems that are more, I think, script problems in its second half.
But all the more reason why it's really leaning on her, right?
Right.
Like, he's the only thing that's going to get you through that shit. And especially when you look at how the movies handle, I mean, I think Aliens is a great occasion for wondering why the Oscars can't have an ensemble category, because I think the acting is so strong actually through the whole thing. And Peggy Sue Got Married seems so weirdly bored by all of its other performers, or unwilling to direct them, or, hiding Joan Allen under ginormous spectacles and not even knowing what you have. But in terms of like a star performance that has to completely thrive by itself, and a star performance that has to totally fire on all cylinders, even though there's a huge ensemble that's also doing a lot of work.
One of the things this time through that really impressed me about Sigourney was how generally non-effusive Ripley is. She's a very sort of contained protagonist. And so like you're constantly watching these insanely great close-ups of her wondering what she's going to do.
As is she.
Right. It's one of these movies where you're watching the actress think. And that can be very fascinating with the right actress. I think what I love most about the performance is her voice, though. I don't know if this is true of Sigourney in general, but Ripley's, she doesn't have this wide range, but once she makes decisions, or once she, or if she already has made a decision about something, there's just something so commanding about her.
Yeah, I do feel like a lot of her characters often feed whatever they're scared of into being totally fed up into projecting real impatience, even when you know that they're the ones who are insecure about whatever it is that's happening. And I think it's, I mean, the movie really serves it, but even in the performance, like, you do get the sense of how terrified she is to be going here, and how much she really earnestly resists it in the beginning of the movie. That doesn't just feel like one of those artificial plot conceits that you know eventually she's going to want to go. I mean, you can tell she's really dead set against this. But once she's there, she's positive she has better ideas than everybody about how get through this.
Yeah, once you've watched the close-up of her making the decision, you know when the decision is made.
Yeah, exactly. And that she really, really hates Bishop, and you don't just wait for the moment when obviously she won't. Like, she hates that fucker.
Right.
The rapport between her and Michael Biehn is so amazing. I mean,
I always forget how much of an ensemble it is. I mean, you brought that up at first, but this time watching it through and noticing all those great wide and medium shots where you see several characters at once.
Yeah.
James Cameron is really into sort of teamwork as the answer.
Yeah.
Which is not something you can say about a lot of action directors.
Yeah. I mean, I would be that way too if I was so excellent at shooting teamwork. But it's great that he even starts from a place of caring about that. And I do think, I mean, in the great Alien versus Aliens debates, like, one can love them both, but I do really like that about Aliens, that it's not just about, I mean, you know, Alien is great, but like you are often spending time in some kind of haunted house room with one of the characters. Just the relations among the group in Aliens are so gripping all the time.
Mm-hmm. My favorite scene for a really long time was my mommy always said there weren't monsters.
Oh, yeah.
Because Sigourney plays Ripley. It's not just a maternal thing, but it's one relationship where she seems completely open to whatever the other person might do. Whereas the other characters, she has preconceived notions about, you know, who they are or how much she hates them, like Bishop.
Yeah.
But she really does sort of let Newt lead her emotions.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really interesting thing. Anyway, I love the performance, but I think it's, you know, consensus that it is one of the best characters in cinema.
Yeah. And like a really like consistent but not the same character in the four different movies, which I thought was really impressive also.
Yeah, I remember, I haven't seen it in a long time and I do plan to watch it this week, but I remember thinking she was really amazing in some key sequences in Alien Resurrection.
Yeah.
Again, a very different interpretation, but still recognizably Ripley.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that about it. And so how high does the movie loom just in terms of your memory of the year? Like, is it it's a top tenner for you, surely?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's in my top 100 of all time.
Ah, okay. Well, there we are.
Yeah, and I think at the time, because that was around the time I started making top 10 lists, too, even though I would see, like, 25 movies a year or something.
Right. Right.
I'm sure it was in my top 10 there, but I'm not sure if I was realizing how amazing it was, because I think I still had some genre bias. You know, most people when they're younger tend to think all the geek stuff, like horror and sci-fi and all that,
yeah,
is really amazing, and then they get old and stuffy like the Academy, and then they think it's B, you know?
Yeah, right, right.
And I sort of did the opposite, maybe because I grew up with the Oscars, where I remember when I was a little kid thinking Gandhi was so amazing and I wished everybody would shut up about E.T., which is such a weird place to come from, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
Now I'm, you know, as an adult, I'm very much more of, why don't people respect great performances in genre work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember, I mean, you know, because I grew up, my dad was in the military, and so we were on bases all the time, and so, like, Aliens and Platoon, which came out, you know, within a few months of each other, were sort of the first time I'd actually seen what my father ostensibly did, like, sort of in a movie, and so first I had all these questions, because I was eight or whatever, about, do you do this every day? I was slightly confused. But I think those two movies are actually a really fascinating parallel, and I think that you know, if you guys remember Platoon, where you get sort of Charlie Sheen's total overwhelmedness in Vietnam with this unseen enemy that seems to have 1,000 faces that are virtually interchangeable to these guys because they just don't care about making distinctions. And then he's got the really, really angelic, like, Willem Dafoe soldier and the really, really satanic Tom Berenger soldier. And
was that the last time Willem Dafoe was angelic?
I think it must have been. I think it must have been. And then everybody else, you know, it's like, that's exactly who they are. They play the role of everybody else. And I just remember thinking that Aliens, in addition to just seeming like, despite those genre biases and despite how tough it was to make Platoon in the 80s when they still didn't want to make Vietnam movies, but it just seemed like such a better Vietnam movie in lots of ways, and it was way more complicated in terms of like the military dynamics within the group, and way less kind of polarized in terms of how it approached all of its characters, so that when somebody does turn out to just be completely evil, like Burke, it really pops. And then it wasn't until later in my life that I was like, wait, in the middle of the Reagan years, they decided that the corporate guy was going to be even worse than the military. That's amazing. They sure snuck that through.
Cameron's always a thorn in the side of the right wingers.
Yeah, I think that just wasn't, I think that was one of my genre biases. I think I partially because of that movie, I always had time for them, but it didn't occur to me that action movies could be anything except kind of totally conservative or totally just kind of status quo in the way they thought about the world. And that one really doesn't.
Get away from her, you bitch!
But what is your favorite picture of that year, 1986?
Well, it should be Hannah and Her Sisters by all rights, because I think that's just an unbelievable movie. Like, there's an Eric Rohmer movie called The Green Ray that's this amazing comedy drama about this single girl in France who was supposed to go on vacation with some of her friends, and then they kind of manage to uninvite her a little bit because they don't dislike her, but if you're going to get rid of anybody in the group because you only have 3 seats instead of 4, it's going to be her. So then she's just trying to find a place to go on vacation, and she's just hilariously neurotic, but you also feel really bad for her, and she keeps trying to sort of take the right trip or meet a boy or not care about meeting a boy, and just when you're kind of on her side, she becomes just completely grating again. It's talk about performances. This woman's unbelievable, but... And it ends with maybe the best ending of a movie ever, which is all I'll say about it.
Okay.
But then there's Hannah and Her Sisters, which, like, you know, seriously couldn't be better. Mm-hmm. Like, how could that movie be better? The answer is, I don't know.
The answer is it couldn't. At the time, I was always, speaking of Kathleen Turner versus Sigourney Weaver,
yeah,
and my constantly conflicting statements about it.
Yeah.
I did the same thing with Hannah and A Room with a View.
Oh, uh-huh.
Where I would just pretend both of them were my number one for that year.
Uh-huh.
Because
I know you love ties.
Everyone knows this about me. Because I think A Room with a View is just the almost the definition of entertaining. Like, uh-huh. I just love every moment.
I'm a little bit, I don't know why it doesn't ever stick with me. And even while I'm watching it, like I mean, any scene that Maggie Smith or Daniel Day-Lewis is in, I'm totally into. And I think it's a totally enjoyable movie, but I catch myself trying to love it, and I'm not even sure what that's about. And I can't remember more than 3 scenes once I'm a week or two out from it. I don't know why that is. I'm really actually curious to see that again.
There's a lot from that year that I haven't seen still because... You know, at the time I wasn't going to movies all the time.
Yeah.
And often, you know, at the mercy of other people.
Right.
But I remember seeing, like, from the Best Actress list, I did see all of them, which may have been the first time that I had done that before the Oscar ceremony.
Oh, you'd already seen them all. Oh, wow.
I mean, I don't remember exactly, but I did see them all.
Yeah.
And, that's why I was so upset when Marley Matlin won.
Whereas I was seeing a girl in horn-rimmed glasses and baby's breath, and I was like, I feel clear that a nerd is winning an award on TV, and this is the most inspiring possible thing. I swear to God. It was like, this could not be better. And William Hurt is kissing her on the cheek, and I hear that they're actually dating, and... it's become clear what a bad time in Marley Matlin's life that was in other ways. But yeah, that spectacle alone of watching four movie stars lose to a nerd was amazing to me. It's half of how I got into the Oscars, I'm not even going to lie. Nerd pride.
Well, you know I've obsessed over that moment myself, but for different reasons.
Yeah.
It is probably my favorite reaction shot of all from the grid of losers.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we talking only about Kathleen or about all four of them?
Only about Kathleen. Yeah. As you know, I've put thought balloons to it before.
I do wish sometimes that she and Samuel L. Jackson, if we could just give them an Oscar and then ask them, do you mind being nominated and losing every year so that we can watch that go? You guys do not like this.
The nominees for a performance by an actress in a leading role are Jane Fonda in The Morning After, Sissy Spacek in Crimes of the Heart, Kathleen Turner in Peggy Sue Got Married, Marley Matlin in Children of a Lesser God, Sigourney Weaver in Aliens.
You know, what's funny is I always think of 1986 as the strong Best Actress year until I actually look at the lineup.
Totally agree.
And yeah. I think it's because Kathleen and Sigourney loom so large in my 80s imagination.
Yeah.
And so I just assume, oh, so it's the best. But it's actually kind of a lame... I mean, Jane Fonda was good in The Morning After, but I don't really remember why I thought so.
I was just looking at an old film comment about the Cannes Film Festival and reading the rest of the articles in there, and one of them was a complaint piece about the Oscars, talking about how only our country would give Jane Fonda an Oscar nomination for half a sneeze of a performance. It's pretty brutal. I mean, the movie's just so terrible, but yeah, I feel the same way. Sometimes you get those years, too, where everybody nominated is so amazing that you forget which movies and roles are... I mean, you don't forget. Who are we talking to? But, you know, it seems like a better year than it is just because of who the names are.
Well, which is why those rosters come into being in the first place.
Exactly.
I mean, I love Sissy Spacek, but for that movie? I mean, even at the time, I remember preferring Jessica Lange in that movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've never heard you say that.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
I don't even mean just about that movie. Just that sentence has never come from me.
I know. We're like two opposites when it comes to Jessica Lange. I really loved her in that. And I'm sure I've told you this before. And maybe because the 80s were so formative for my taste in acting and everything. But I remember... It was one of the first performances where I noticed like an actual choice that an actor was making like all the way through a movie.
Oh, uh-huh.
I kept noticing that her voice took on a different tone depending on which sister she was talking to.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if I noticed that because it was pronounced. I haven't seen the movie in a long time. Or if I projected that onto it, but I remember thinking, oh, actors make so many decisions.
That's cool. I kind of like that when you find out that there are movies that you would probably, you know, feel differently about if you saw them later, but that you still remember why they were the first time you had a thought like that.
Yeah, I remember the only thing I remember other than the Jessica Lange voice thing and the way she cut her hair was how hard I laughed at Sissy Spacek's big joke in the movie, the having a bad day.
Oh, right. Right.
But that's really all that I remember about the movie.
I saw it not too long ago again. And it's to me, it's one of those movies where you're just watching how much fun the actresses obviously had as soon as somebody yelled cut. But what's on screen just seems so... I mean, just watching Diane Keaton be that bad is really hard. And watching Tess Harper talk about getting nominated for half a sneeze of a performance. God.
It's a full sneeze. It's just only one type of sneeze for an entire movie, right?
sort of. What a strange performer she is. But to nominate one Woody Allen sister and not the other two, who I think all should have been leads, we can play that game. But skip her, but nominate Tess Harper. Oh my God. But I think what's funny about that year, too, is that... because that was the first Oscars that I watched, and because I mean, Aliens would have come on time to our Marine base, but most movies are like 6 months delayed or something. Like, you get them at the same time that a $3 theater would get them now.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost everything that was up for the Oscar came after the awards for us. And because I had, for whatever reason, although I say that, it really was the nerd thing. Like, I decided, this is the honor roll. You know, like, these are the movies that got A's. Like, I need to see these movies. And so I kind of wheedled my parents into taking me to, I think, all five of the Best Picture movies. And so I saw all of those and Crimes of the Heart and, like, The Morning After right away. But even though I was, like, in fourth grade or fifth grade, I still haven't seen, like, you know, whatever the pop movies. Like, wasn't Beverly Hills Cop 2 that year? And Crocodile Dundee I didn't see forever. And so it's just a weird time, like, for that point in my life to have seen the movies that I saw and skipped the movies that I still haven't.
Right. Did you see Blue Velvet at the time?
I didn't see that until college, I don't think.
Okay.
And then it was just on, and that it's kind of like A Room with a View for me. I watch it and I admire it, even probably even more than A Room with a View, but for some reason it doesn't, maybe it's something about the second half, or once, like, what's his name? Dean Stockwell and Dennis Hopper get so important. Like, that one doesn't get to me the way a lot of his other ones do. But it was just on in the video store when I was there 3 days ago, and was making me feel like I really need to see it again immediately.
Oh, Blue Velvet?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really weird one for me, because I think every time I've watched it, I have not watched the whole thing in one sitting.
Yeah.
And you know how that can be really detrimental to some movies?
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that is one of those movies.
I almost wonder if it would help it. Like, I mean, I don't... Only because my reaction to it is so... I mean, the filmmaking seems so compartmentalized. Like, her apartment or the club where they go or whatever. It seems like the scenes are really insulated against each other in a way.
Hmm. But I think you need them rubbing up against each other.
I'm sure you do. You're right.
Because I, to this day, even though I love Lynch, I'm kind of always confused that people think it's his best movie.
Yeah, I don't get that.
Yeah, because I think I like almost all of them more than Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
So some of the other big movies that year, Top Gun.
Which I also didn't see till college.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hoosiers, which still gets mentioned by a lot of people.
A lot of people love that movie a lot.
Yeah.
The Fly, which I saw right away and have never let go of.
I was just watching that the other day, actually. It's really good.
That's so great.
Cronenberg is so underrated, but that goes back to genre bias again.
Yep.
Little Shop of Horrors.
The movie itself kind of formative for you?
I wouldn't say formative. I was already really obsessed with musicals because that's what I grew up on as a little kid. I'm pretty sure it made my top 10 list of the 20 movies I saw. But it's more, I love it more because of the score and because of Ellen Green than because I think it's a great movie, per se. But I would have nominated her for Best Actress for sure.
Yeah, I know you're a big champion of that.
Easily, like, the three that are no question in my list would be Turner, Weaver, and her.
Okay.
And the other two spots would be more difficult.
The gutter. It's a night spot. I work there my nights off when we weren't making much money. I put on cheap and tasteless outfits, not nice ones like this.
I think Melanie Griffith is really super in Something Wild, which is another one I didn't see for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But she and Jeff Daniels, I think Ray Liotta got a lot of the acting credit for kind of playing the psycho, but
right.
They're both so good. Well, she especially, I think, is good at something that I feel like I started watching in a different way because of you, when actors are really nailing stylization in a
mm-hmm.
really compelling way, and she's really funny in it, and she would have been up there for me, as would he have been. I like Marley Matlin and Children of a Lesser God, but I realize that we can only get so far in that conversation between the two of us. I do think there are sequences in that movie where it's clear that we're dealing with a new actress, but there are other ones about her resentment of the other students combined with her jealousy of them that I think are pretty compelling. I mean, she would have stuck around for me longer than most of the other people on that list.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this was true of the 80s, because I'm not as much of a Golden Globe historian as Oscars, obviously.
Yeah.
But it is really interesting that the drama list it is so not the Oscar list. It's only Marley and Sigourney. And then you have Julie Andrews in Duet for One, Anne Bancroft in Night Mother, and Farrah Fawcett in Extremities.
Have you seen that?
I have not.
I haven't either.
But I do remember that whole Farrah Fawcett wave of, oh my god, she can act.
I remember that too, and I've just never sort of caught up with it.
Right.
You would think that a movie starring an actress being put through something called Extremities is something we would sprint to go see. But I'll stump for Molly Ringwald in Pretty in Pink, too, going
on the
other side of genre prejudices. I think everybody in that movie is really good, but that whatever the quality is that the world responded to in her, I respond to most in that. Here in the south of France, in a couple of days, I will be seeing Sid and Nancy, which I've never seen. For a lot of reasons, to include her performance, but also Gary Oldman's and just what people say about the movie is something I'm really excited to catch up with at long last. Yeah, it turned out to be a really interesting year. There was a lot going on. I just saw She's Gotta Have It, which I had not crossed, you know, I'd never made a point of seeing. Have you seen that? The Spike Lee, his first movie?
I have, but I don't. Is it worth checking out again?
It is. I mean, my feeling about it was that it preserves most of the qualities that I already associate with Spike Lee. I mean, it's really funny and really tart when it is those things. It's really uneven. It sometimes just completely antagonizes one of its characters all of a sudden for what seemed like really unnecessary reasons. So it didn't sort of change me one way or the other, but there was something kind of great about it does have a little bit of a zestier energy than...
Well, that's often true of debuts.
That's true. And so it's like the Spike Lee, completely recognizable as the Spike Lee that we already know, love, don't love, however you feel about him, it's the same guy, but with that kind of first-timer vitality to it.
Mm, okay. Have you ever seen Betty Blue?
No.
Because I was, I mean, not at the time, I wasn't into it, but after the fact on VHS, I became really into that, which was a foreign film nominee.
And like a pretty gutsy foreign film nominee.
Oh yeah, it opens with a fucking scene, basically. Just this slow zoom on Jean-Yu Anglade, and I always just call her Betty Blue, Beatrice Dahl.
Yeah.
Who, maybe she would have been on my best actress list.
She is compelling. I've never seen her and not thought she might eat the co-star in her scene. Not because she's stealing the scenes, or because she just looks...
And literally in trouble every day.
Exactly. Maybe that pushed her over the edge for me, but yeah. God, talk about uncanny presences.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen Betty Blue in since the late 80s, but it might be a case where it's just like the perfect person with the perfect role in its debut energy. And I remember just being completely riveted by her. Which, you know, is saying something, because Jean-Yu Anglade was naked.
Yeah.
So.
It's a bottomless starlet. Well, and staying in France for a second, a movie that's been new to me with this Cannes project, a French movie called Thérèse, about this 19th century, I mean, this will sound like it's a biopic, which it's ingeniously manages not to be, but it is about a real woman who was a teenage nun in the end of the 19th century, and kept this diary, I guess, about her own very youthful, really idiosyncratic relationship to God. It was on a lot of people's 10 best lists, and I'd never heard of it, but it was really terrific.
Okay, so The Green Ray and Thérèse.
You got it.
Two for you Francophiles out there if you haven't seen it.
Right. Well, it's been fun being 25 years younger with you.
Actually, I wouldn't want to be that young again.
Fair enough.
I would like to remove 10 years.
Yeah. But let's not overdo it. But I'm sure people will comment, or I hope they will, about what they either remember about that year or other things.
Yeah, and for those of you who were born after 86, what makes you go back? I'm always curious to know that about when people decide to rent movies from before their time.
Yeah.
Is it the Oscar list? Is it you know, just people talking about a movie. Would love to hear those comments too.
Yeah. So thanks for listening to all this incredibly self-indulgent walk down memory lane for the two of us.
And make sure to check out Nick's Flick Picks for his review. Lots of reviews from Can86.
Talk to you soon.